Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Susan Tucker, whose new book is City of Remembering, A History of Genealogy in New Orleans, and Marco Orlando Littell, author of Each Vagabond by Name, and her publisher, Abram Himmelstein, of the University of New Orleans Press. Susan Tucker is the author of Telling Memories Among Southern Women, a collection of oral histories by Black domestic workers and their white employers. She's edited The Scrapbook in American Life, such a gorgeous book, and the wonderful New Orleans Cuisine, 14 signature dishes and their histories. Now she's back with a new book of her own, City of Remembering, A History of Genealogy in New Orleans. She's speaking to us today from Baltimore, where she's been enjoying her granddaughter Tilly's very first year. Susan Tucker, I'm so happy to have you on The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm very glad to be here.
City of Remembering was such an eye-opener for me. You know, I've never been particularly into genealogy, but now I see the attraction. And you said that the first rule of genealogy is begin with the self. And you did that with two extraordinary paintings.
Yes, well, that is the first rule, begin with the self, which makes it easy, I guess, because we're all sort of egocentric in this world. And I began with those portraits. What genealogists made me see was that everything is both public and private. So you have these things that you think, oh, they're hanging in my house and one can see them, and yet they also have a story, and you know the story. Or someone in your family knows the story. It could be about a photograph, it could be about anything. But it makes you realize that genealogy has this popularity for many reasons, but in large part because it is both personal and very public. It's who we are. It has all these generations of DNA within us.
And you tell us the story of one man's importance in genealogy in New Orleans. And he's a very well-known figure in New Orleans history, Père Antoine of St. Louis Cathedral. And he established the state's first preservation program. And that was as far back as the 1780s.
Right. Well, what's so amazing about that, too, is that not only did he begin copying the records, so you can imagine they'd been keeping records since the early 1700s. And he went into the archives and saw that the paper was not holding up. And the Spanish were very good record keepers all over the world. So there was sort of this template where the Catholic priests and the notaries were going out and they were following rules. And he saw that these papers were going to crumble. And so he started with a cantor in the church who was also called the archivist, which is something New Orleans should be really proud of, that we've had these archivists that go back so far. And he started copying the records. Now, he started copying them, and he put the copies in another building. So what he did, in essence, is that he also took some measures that said, you know, not each building is going to stand if we have a disaster, which we know from Katrina, it is wise to have backups.
That's the first off-site storage facility for archives, maybe.
Yes.
And there were some other interesting individuals who made signal contributions, weren't there?
Well, one of my favorites is Laura Porteous, and she was the translator of the Spanish judicial records. And she lived from 1875 to 1952. But she started in the early 20s, every day, until almost the late 1940s, going into the Cabildo and translating these records. And she becomes this sort of hero because what she does is by then, New Orleans is becoming more and more a English-speaking city. And she makes these records available to the English-speaking population. But she's also interesting because she, of course, knew Spanish really well. She was really a scholar, and she knew she was a scholar. And she also did her own family history. But In terms of genealogy, you also see this split between the public and the private, which is always there. The records are public that she's working with, but she's doing her own family history, and then her papers end up at LSU, even though she worked every day at the Cabildo. And you'd often see this public-private split where people think, oh, maybe that's too much detail. Maybe they need to go a little further from home to tell the story of my family. So she's another one of the heroes. What I did was I picked individuals that made it possible for us today to have the records that we have online, say on Ancestry.com. And you have someone like Sousa Young Gates, who was one of the 58 children of Brigham Young. And at the end of the 19th century, the Genealogical Society of Utah was just forming its library, and she insisted that the library would be open to people who were not members of the LDS Church. And she also taught genealogy, and so she taught different ways to fill out forms, and those forms eventually made up the first databases that we have in places like the Family History Library in Utah. So what you see in genealogy is you see these huge layers of projects that are really done by people who are just dedicated to the records. You have Pierre Antoine, you have Laura Porteous, you have Sousa Young Gates, and you have these hundreds of thousands of others who are doing this that we never hear about, but who go into the cemeteries and copy down records, who index the first census of America. So you have this local culture in New Orleans, but you also have this universe of records that's feeding into it because, of course, we know people are never stationary. They're moving. And the records are moving.
Now, New Orleans has some particular quirks for genealogical researchers. Climate, of course, is a major concern, right?
Right.
And there are some particularly great collections right here for genealogists to use.
Well, the Notarial Archives is probably one of the most unusual, the most almost magnificent archives in America. And it is so because, as one of the genealogists said to me, if my ancestors had a shoestring, they went to a notary and had it written down. You know, and so that was part of the French and the Spanish culture that was allowed to continue in New Orleans. And because it continued, then we have all the commercial transactions that went forward in the central archive. And not only that, but it became a centralized repository even before the notarial archives in France became centralized. And largely that was the result of Reconstruction politics, that it became a centralized place. But it's quite an unusual archive and just rich, rich, rich with information. And New Orleans also becomes really important in genealogy because we were such a huge port of debarkation. So we have all these people coming through New Orleans. So even if a lot of people didn't stay in New Orleans, their family's story of being an American begins in New Orleans.
And then tell us about that young man, Jari Onra, whom I thought was so interesting.
Well, he graduated from Tulane University. He has a degree in history. And he started genealogy, I think, when he was 9 years old. And like many genealogists, he was interested in collecting, and I think he was interested in Boy Scouts, and a lot of those things that you do as a child. But he, and probably the people around him, had the good sense to get him into the public library. And the public library itself is a sort of a hero and one of the foundations of genealogy in New Orleans and elsewhere. So Jari goes into the public library, and he meets older practicing genealogists, and they take him under the wing. And so he's been doing this. He's in his early 20s now, almost all his life, really, when you think about it. So he has a head start there because people say, if I'd only asked my grandmother. It's a real regret that many people have that they didn't start earlier.
Right. Another one of my favorite chapters was the one called Treasures, Memory Objects, Private Records, Science, and Art. And you have some of the most exquisite photographs of birth certificates, commonplace books, and you come right up to the present with the work of contemporary artist Jan Gilbert, who uses her own family history in her art.
Right. It's so interesting because people, if you ask them, and I often did ask, you know, what record do you value the most? Some of them would return to the public records, but many, many wanted to return to the personal records, to those things that had been passed in a family. And those are quite beautiful. And we do forget how beautiful they can be. And I did like finding them. I loved both the people who would pull things out from the closet and show me things, and the people who, like Jan, showed me how they used them in their lives and made an object or an art piece that was something different, that took the record forward to another generation.
And there are beautiful objects, like the person who had a pipe that had belonged to an ancestor, or a quilt. I mean, so many of our connections are through these tangible objects, too.
Right. The pipe is a wonderful story by Jack Belsom, who's a very active genealogist in New Orleans, and he couldn't find one ancestor. He couldn't find him. He searched everywhere. And one day when he was cleaning the house, he found this pipe. And the pipe had written on it the name of a town. And sure enough, he went to that town. He'd never been to those records before. He went to the records in that town, and he found the man who had been missing, all because that pipe was saved. And, you know, we live in a culture now where we have so much, and we want to throw things away often, or we want to clean out. But there is something to be said for keeping objects, and particularly keeping objects that have some meaning to us.
Yes, indeed. And that's one of the things about this book that's so beautiful, is that you do have these exquisite photographs of these objects. And even the paper records themselves are quite lovely to look at.
Oh, the handwriting.
Yes.
The handwriting is so beautiful, the flourishes of the notaries. And I think what I liked about showing the documents, and it was one thing that I insisted in this book, was that I show the beauty of the documents, is that they show you the details of care that goes into the creation of things that we think are just mundane, but they're not. And also, when we think about genealogy, in large part, it is a response to two things in American society. One is migration, that we are all, unless we are American Indian, are new to this country. And why did we come here? And to create a beautiful object out of loss seems to me a wonderful response. And second, we're also responding, I think, to democracy, which was why Roots was so popular. And it's because we think we're going to base our country on individuals, and each individual was going to count, and yet we had slavery. And how do we learn how those ancestors confronted those huge problems?
Well, there's so much to think about and just to enjoy. We've been talking with Susan Tucker, whose beautiful new book is City of Remembering, A History of Genealogy in New Orleans. You can meet her Tuesday, June 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Susan, I can't wait to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Yeah!
Marco Orlando Littell grew up in small-town southwestern Pennsylvania, the setting for her first novel, Each Vagabond by Name. She left home for college in Ohio, then went on to grad school at Columbia University, then lived in Spain, California, and Brooklyn, before settling in New Jersey, where she works as a writer and editor. Today, we'll be talking about that novel, Each Vagabond by Name, the winner of the very first University of New Orleans Press Publishing Lab Prize. With Marco today is the editor-in-chief of the UNO Press, Abram Himmelstein. So welcome, Margo.
Thank you so much.
You too, Abram. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad to be here.
Good. So how did this prize come about for UNO Press?
Part of my duties is I get to teach classes, and so I had gone through the MFA program here, and I was trying to think of what had wanted to learn while I was in grad school that I hadn't learned, and a lot of that was how to interact with the publishing world. And so we thought of this idea of having a class go through the process of publishing, and then I guess a lot of presses would have a slush pile already there, and we didn't, and so we had to do the work of creating people who wanted to be published. You know, a lot of the work that we usually do at UNO Press is people come to us early in their process and say, hey, I have a book that I'm thinking about, and then we work with them for a few years, and that book becomes a reality. We needed a bunch of finished books to look at, and so we came up with the idea of creating this prize and asked people to submit, and we got 70-some-odd people who sent us finished books, and we got to begin the process of wading through them.
Wow. And how many students are involved in this effort?
We had 16 students in the first class.
So, Margo, you rose to the top of the slush pile. So how did you find out about the prize yourself? And I understand that you think St. Jude played a helpful role in your success.
It's hard not to think that. I found out about the prize through an online group of writers, and one of these members posted a notice about the contest. And I decided to toss my hat into the ring. I was in the process of submitting the novel to contests as a way of getting it published, and this just seemed like a really promising setup with the students and the selection process and the end result of all these people being behind the book. It really appealed to me, so I submitted my novel. I was very hopeful at the time, but I'd been in this position before, and a handful of times before I'd entered it in a contest with publication as the prize, and it had been a finalist, and then it ultimately was not the one selected. And so this time I tried something new. I thought, this book has been a lost cause, and who better to help me out in a position like this than St. Jude, the patron saint of lost causes? I'm a selective Catholic, grown up as a Catholic, and sometimes the saints come in handy. So I prayed a novena to St. Jude, which is 9 prayers, said particular intention, and after the 8th prayer, I got an email saying I'd won. So,
whoa, I would believe
miracles,
that too.
Yes.
And how appropriate for New Orleans, where St. Jude occupies
this is true.
Special
all
place,
the stars
you know.
Were aligned.
Now, Abram, you told me this great story about reading this novel and being afraid some New York publisher would snap it up.
It's true. So we divided up all the books in the slush pile. Everybody had to read 6 or 7. And so I was reading my 6 or 7. And after the first class, somebody came back and said, I think I have the one. And we all looked at her and she said, no, like, it's really amazing. And so even though I had my own to read, I went home and I opened the Word file and there it was. As I read deeper into the novel, I was like, wow, we have this amazing, amazing book. And now I really, really am afraid that somebody's going to buy it out from under us, or a New York house will publish this before we get the chance to publish it. And then we still committed to the entire process. We winnowed it from 70 to 10, and then we took 2 weeks to move through those 10, and everybody read all 10 of those. And so as we were going through that process, there was just this growing concern in the class that, like, we know which one we want to marry, and we need to go ahead and ask and propose. But the process played itself out, and we sent Margot the email and crossed our fingers.
And it worked.
Yeah.
So, Margot, talk a little bit about writing this book. It's about a small town called Shelk, and two people named Ramsey and Stella who have strong ties to the place and strong ties to each other.
These characters have been with me a really long time. They started out as characters in a very short story, a 7-page short story that I wrote way back in 1999. It was the first thing I'd written for my MFA program, and they didn't feel finished after that. They kept living, kept breathing, and several years later, I turned them into a novella. And even at that point, their stories didn't feel finished. But it took me another 7 years before I finally went back to them and said, okay, let's see what else you can do. So I tripled the length. It was about 300 pages at that point. And finally, their stories were fleshed out and complete. Ramsey came to me a long time ago, originally. An offhand comment from a bartender friend in a restaurant where I was waitressing had told me about another small bar in southwestern Pennsylvania with a bartender who had an eye that he'd lost, but no one seemed very surprised that he'd lost the eye. And that image really stuck with me. And it was in 1999, and I jotted that note to myself at night so I wouldn't forget it, taped it in an old notebook. And that was the origin of Ramsey. And he just came to life from there, but I feel like he came into my life fully formed. Stella took a little while longer to develop.
So read us a little bit and give us a sense of this great place.
Sure. This is from the beginning of the novel. It was an ordinary fall until the gypsies came. Leaves changed, fell, and clogged the curbside gutters. Crackling footsteps approached and receded, and the blue sky took Ramsey's breath when he glimpsed it through his bar's small window. For the first time in years, it made him feel hopeful, even though he knew better. There wasn't any more reason to feel hopeful in the fall than at any other time, and anyone who believed otherwise was setting himself up for a life of disappointment. The blue of the sky and the smoky burning leaves in the air didn't hold any magic, and they would disappear, just like the hot yellow days of summer. Still, Ramsey felt something different this year, some stirring in his blood. Each morning when he gazed at the maples like red smoke on the hills, he found himself unable to look away, as though something he'd been waiting for would fly out any moment from the branches. Zachariah Ramsey was a tall man, with long white hair and skin the color of whiskey. He had only one eye, bright blue and peering from a web of veins. The other socket was empty, sewn over with bits of skin, as red and raw as though the eye had been removed that day. It hadn't. He'd lost it in Vietnam, but it looked that way. The patch he used to wear made people too curious. Eventually, he left it off. Few people wanted to look at Ramsey now, which gave him plenty of time to study them.
It was an ordinary fall until the gypsies came has got to be one of the best sentences ever. I mean, if that doesn't pique a reader's curiosity, nothing will. So tell us a little bit about those gypsies and the disruptive effect they have on the community of Shelk.
The gypsies are a band of itinerant teenagers, runaways, who travel around and set up camp in small towns and begin robbing people's homes. These thieves don't have their sights set on a wealth. They can't in places like this. They're just trying to get by. The thefts they commit are small. The things they steal are not that valuable. They're just trying to make it from day to day. The gypsies, as I had originally imagined them, did really come through southwestern Pennsylvania in the early 2000s. There was a rash of small petty thefts, and they were outsiders who were committing these thefts, and the people called them gypsies. And I remember being so struck by this. I was living in New York at the time and would talk to my mother on the phone, and she would tell me the news of home, and the gypsies were big. That was a big deal. And I suddenly realized that what I was working on at the time would come to life if I introduced some outsiders into the story. So Ramsey and Stella had been in this very insular world, working against each other and with each other, and nothing really was jumping off the page until I brought the gypsies in. And that was the line that started it all. It was an ordinary fall until the gypsies came. I wrote that line, and it was like the world of Ramsey and Stella cracked open.
Well, you have such an elegant structure in this novel, you know, with the beginning is an address in the town and the gypsies observing what's inside the house at that address. And you render lives in such small objects, which I love, because that's the way we do live. We attach significance and tenderness to these objects in our past. That must have been a lot of fun for you to write.
Writing those chapter opening vignettes was one of my favorite parts of writing this novel. I really got to think about all the homes I'd seen growing up and that I still saw. And, you know, when I went home for visits, I thought about the things people valued. And it really was fun for me to create those tiny worlds and to imagine what happens when an outsider enters into that world, into that home where things are so precious and so meticulously arranged, and they take them or move them. And that was really fun for me.
Well, you write with such exquisite tenderness and observation. I mean, it's a real gift to see in this book, I have to say. So, Abram, how do you think it all worked out? Do you think your students got what they should have out of this process?
I'm so happy with this book, and I've spent a lot of time trying to think about if there's something magic in the process, or if Margot's book was the magic, or if these students were the magic. It's going to be interesting because we're going to do the class again in the fall with nonfiction, and so I'm interested to see how much of the process is repeatable. I guess on the front side, I didn't feel like we'd have that much problem finding a book. The part that was interesting to me was how smoothly the editing went. Mm-hmm. And so to have 16 voices in the editorial room was terrifying, but it was just such a pleasure to work with those students. They were amazing at that process. And then Margot was amazing at kind of taking our suggestions and running with the ones that she felt like worked with the book.
Well, that'll be fun. I can't wait to see what happens this fall.
Yeah, I'm excited to see that book come, and I'm really excited to have each vagabond by name alive in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Margo, so are you deep into your next book?
I am. I have one that's complete, more or less, and one that I'm deep into right now. I've written a draft, and I'm working on the revisions now.
Oh, I can't wait. We've been talking with Margo Orlando Littell, author of Each Vagabond by Name, winner of the first UNO Press Publishing Lab Prize, and Abram Himmelstein, editor-in-chief of the University of New Orleans Press. Thanks, you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Nevada Bar signs Boar Island, the most recent mystery in the series featuring National Park Ranger Anna Pigeon, Tuesday, May 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. Colin Campbell reads from and signs Free Days with George, learning life's little lessons from one very big dog, Wednesday, June 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. The Foundation Gallery at 1109 Royal Street opens an exhibit, Books Catalyst, a book art survey curated by John Caulfield. Friday, June 3rd at 6. Exhibiting artists include Pinky Bass, Doug Bulas, Dana Jo Cooley, Wayne McNeil, Buzz Spector, and Travis Childers, with selections from many private book arts collections as well. This exhibit runs through June 26th. The Pirates Alley Faulkner Society holds its annual fundraiser, Juleps in June, Friday, June 3rd. The literary guests of honor this year are Carrie Brown, John Gregory Brown, and Dr. Kim Vaz DeVille. For more information, email Faulkhouse, that's F-A-U-L-K, house, at AOL.com for tickets. Walker Percy Weekend kicks off June 3rd through 5th, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moviegoer in the historic district of St. Francisville. There will be panel discussions and social events, and special guests include Jason Barry, Mary McKay, Christopher Harris, and Patrick Samway. For more information and tickets, check out walkerpercyweekend.org. This weekend is the annual Symphony Book Fair, which will be returning to the Lakefront Arena at 6801 Franklin Avenue, June 3rd through 5th. Hours are Friday and Saturday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., Sunday, 9 a.m. to 4. There's an admission fee Friday from 9 to 3, but after that, admission is free. Saturday, June 4th is a big day for young readers in our listening area, as summer reading programs kick off all over the place. New Orleans Public Libraries host events at the following branches Saturday: the Main Library, Algiers, Alvar, and East New Orleans Regional; Mid-City and Norman Mayer all get started at 2. Events at Hubble begin at 11 a.m. The Children's Resource Center and Rosa Keller begin at 1. Central City kicks off Friday, June 3rd at 12:30. And there's an adult summer reading program this year as well. Check out neworleanspubliclibrary.org for the details. Library Palooza, the kickoff for the 2016 summer reading program in the Jefferson Parish Libraries, starts Saturday, June 4th from 10 a.m. to 3 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, and from 10 a.m. to 2 Saturday, June 4th at the Jane O'Brien Chatelaine West Bank Regional Library. That's in Harvey. That kickoff will feature a medieval festival created by the Barony of Axmore, part of the Society for Creative Anachronism, a nonprofit society dedicated to the preservation of the Middle Ages. Nancy Backus Roniger signs A Bayou Home, The Adventures of Swampmaster Bijou, Saturday, June 4th at 11 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Pamela Skjolsvik reads from and signs Death Becomes Us, Sunday, June 5th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Lauren S. Carden reads from and signs Fashion and Fiction, Self-Transformation in 20th Century American Literature, Tuesday, June 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Susan Tucker, discusses and signs City of Remembering, A History of Genealogy in New Orleans, Tuesday, June 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And if you'd like to read ahead, the next meeting of the Maple Street Bookshop Book Club is June 9th at 6 at the shop. Ann Giovanno facilitates a discussion of There Was an Old Woman Who Loved Her Children Until They Moved Back In, a trio of novellas by Russian writer Lyudmila Petrushevskaya. The Angela King Gallery is presenting the touring exhibition, Oh, the Places You'll Go, a portfolio of artwork by Dr. Seuss. It will be on display now through June 25th at the gallery at 241 Royal Street. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.